Happy Friday, guys, and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Dubs. I'm your host, Bill T. Well, you know what this means. It means it's Friday, and you're either getting ready to go to work or you're getting ready to kick off the weekend, and I'm here bringing you some cool VW content, and that's my job. Your job is to share this podcast. So I enlist you, by proxy of you being a listener, to share the podcast with all your friends. Make sure you guys share this thing. We continue to keep growing. We've broken 500,000 downloads total overall, which may not seem like a lot, but those are worldwide downloads of people that have listened to some excellent VW talk, get a lot of insight and history on people in the hobby, and we can only grow from there. And there's thousands and thousands of more people. And so from the thousands of people that listen, they can then send it out to their friends, and then their friends can send it to their friends. So we, like everything else in this hobby, it's grown organically, and we push by showing our friends the right way. I mean, you wouldn't let your friend put the wrong oil in his car, right? No, you wouldn't. So don't let your friend listen to some hot trash that's out there. Make sure they get connected to listen to Let's Talk Dubs and get some insight and some of the history and background behind our beloved hobby. So with that, we're going to be continuing on with a couple weeks ago, you'd heard my podcast with Alex Bowgin and his father and son built 75 Beetle. And, you know, we originally recorded that at the Volksworld show. Well, while I was there, obviously making lots of connections, it was a crazy weekend. For the whole weekend, just for the show aspect, I spent most of the time recording in a studio. Didn't get, you know, I would get down to the show for like an hour and whatever. And, you know, when you start making friends over there, it's no different than our friends over here, right? We become quick buddies and everybody wants to introduce you to their friends. And then you're just like, oh man, yeah, I'd like to sit down with you. I'd like to sit down with you. So there's tons more people over there in the UK we're going to be having on the podcast, as well as a lot more people here stateside and really around the world that are involved in this VW hobby. So I hope you guys are enjoying it. Today's podcast is going to be with Paul Medhurst, who's better known as Type 2 Detectives. A workshop in the UK that's been building, servicing, selling, and maintaining people's Volkswagens. And he's got a long storied history, goes way back to Carbon Connection, Type 3 Detectives, and lots of in between. And so he's one of the staples in the VW scene back there in the UK. And I love getting the history, getting down to how they got into it. And he's buddies with a lot of my friends over there. And so we're getting in the woodwork over there. And I hope you guys are enjoying it, because I definitely love hearing the stories. I love hearing the similarities between their hobby and our hobby. And we're two different sides of the world, but you know, these guys are, they're into the same thing. And you know, funny thing is, we're all inspired by some of these things that we see in magazines, which is our analog means of communication back then, you know. And I think it's funny, you know, some kids these days may not appreciate it, but one day they'll say, oh yeah, I remember back when we were on social media and we used to get all in this inspiration and all that. But ours comes from the magazines and snapshots and a still picture we'd look at for 4 years while building a car. And like, one day I'm going to capture the essence of what's in that shot. And I think that's just so great about the hobby, is how it took so little to motivate us, but it was just a snapshot of somewhere we weren't, where we were trying to get to. So with that, we're going to get into it with Paul Medhurst. Type 2 Detectives is his shop now. You're going to know a bunch of cars. If you guys subscribe to Volksworld, even pick up a Volksworld every now and again, you'll know some of these cars that they've put out there. But we're going to get into those details and his story as we get into the podcast. And don't forget to like, follow, share, and subscribe. Go to our YouTube channel, subscribe to that. Go to our Facebook page, subscribe to that. And also, One Crazy Weekend is coming up October 3rd through the 5th here in Las Vegas. Go today to letstalkdubs.com, get registered for the show, book your room now. I've already got people from the UK that are coming in. It may be a big British invasion this year, so I want you guys to go get your room secured. There's plenty of rooms available now. The closer we get to the date, I don't want to hear people say, oh man, I don't have a room, this is such a bummer, because I assure you the rooms will get sold out. So there's tons of rooms available. They're super, super cheap, and only in Vegas, right? What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Going to be the best time of your life, and I can guarantee that. So other than that, guys, we're going to get into our sponsors at the end and do some shout outs at the end of the podcast. So right now, let's get into it. Paul Medhurst, Type 2 Detectives on Let's Talk Dubs.
You probably don't know that there's a new Volkswagen out that doesn't look like a Volkswagen.
Okay, everybody. So on today's show, I've got another one of the staples of the VW scene in the UK, and that's Paul Medhurst. You've heard of Type 3 detectives, which later evolved into Type 2 detectives. And they've been, his history goes back a long time in the UK, early into the days of Carmen Connection, things like that. We're going to get into all that. But if you're not familiar, by the end of this podcast, you will be. But on today's show, I'm going to welcome Paul Medhurst from Cambridge, England, and with Type 2 detectives. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, so, you know, we have some mutual friends, and I understand you and Spike have been, you guys have been mates since you're 17. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we met in a Kentucky Fried Chicken car park, I seem to remember. Oh. But, yeah, we've kept friends ever since, and, yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, no, he's he and I've become pretty good buddies, and it's definitely something that that he's given me a lot of insight as to some of your guys' background. And he says now that your nickname is Puppy. Is that what your friends call you?
It's not really what my sort of friends in the town call me. It's more of a Volkswagen derived nickname. My first magazine feature was, I think it was, it derived from that. It was my first magazine feature was a square back, and it was, I think the magazine title, Volkswagen magazine, always used to give strange titles, and because it was, I think the title of the feature was Puppy Love, and from that day on, it was, it kind of stuck. But yeah, a lot of people still call me that, even though I'm not a puppy anymore, more an old dog.
It's the blessing and the curse of getting featured in the magazine. Sometimes your friends will just pin you with the most ridiculous thing they can find, right?
Yeah, there was another one actually. Jumping forward several years, but the next car on from the square back, I had a notchback, and it was featured in VW Trends, one of their European vacations or whatever they did.
Uh huh.
European invasion, not one of the early, slightly later than the Richie King one, but. When I signed my signature, my surname's Medhurst, but when I signed my signature, it looks like Mealhurst. And the VW Trends saw my signature on the release notes, and they called the feature Mealhurst's Marvel. And that has stuck as well with a certain friend of mine. He still calls me Mealhurst to this day. So. Yeah. Be careful how you sign your name.
Right. And so now the way we always start the podcast is, how did you get into Volkswagens and what's your VW story?
Okay. Well, I was quite young, hence the name Puppy. Hence why the guys at Volkswagen wanted to call me Puppy, because I was so young. But even rewind a few years from that first feature, I remember it vividly. I was going on a school camping trip. I was 13 years old, and on the way we stopped at some motorway services on the M3, which is motorway out of London towards the sort of the New Forest area of England. And we stopped at the motorway services, and I went into the bookstore and bought a magazine. It was called Custom Car Magazine. And Keith Hume, who's still around, had written a segment of a magazine called VWXYZ, or VWXYZ, as we might say in England. And it was a supplement within the custom car, the general custom car magazine. There was a Volkswagen supplement in there called VWXYZ. And during that camping trip, I read it from cover to cover, backwards and forwards, turned the thing inside out. And this was pre-Volkswagen. I think this was probably the sort of pilot for Volkswagen potentially. And a few months later, Volkswagen magazine was launched, and I bought the first Volkswagen. And then a really good friend of mine, someone I'm actually employing now, a guy called Pat, several years older than me, but he took pity on me and gave me my first car, yeah. which was a bit of a basket case, and I didn't actually get round to restoring that. It was condemned before I got that far. But then that car went, and then a few months later, I was riding my BMX bike through the local town, and I saw some what we call wings, but you guys would call fenders, up the side of someone's sort of garage at home. And I said to the guy, "Have you got the rest?" And it was, they were like small sort of 1200 backlights.
Yeah.
And I said to the guy, "Have you got the rest of the car that goes with them?" And he kind of came over and he went, "Yeah, I have actually." And I said, "Is it for sale?" He went, "Yeah, it could be." He said, "I said, where is it?" And he said, "It's in town behind the post office." And he said, "But you can't go there." He said, "Come back here tomorrow morning, and we'll go and have a look." So me and my friend jumped on our bikes, rode straight round there immediately. And we went around the back of the post office up a driveway, and in there in the barn, it was like a barn find, 1962 original paint anthracite bug.
Oh, wow.
With no fenders. And I'd not been to many shows back then, and it was kind of the earliest thing. I mean, it was kind of, I'd seen an oval, but never really up close, and it was kind of the old, to me it just looked prehistoric. So the next day I did a deal, and I paid like £150 for it, which is like $250 back then, I suppose, and sort of restored it to the sort of what I would describe as sort of UK cow look, sort of dechromed, painted refrigerator white, not traditional cow look like, you know, the DKP cars, but you know what we were doing back in the sort of late 80s,
right?
Here and in America, and sort of went from there. And yeah, by this stage, sort of Volkswagen was getting up and going, and I'd kind of be the first person in the newsagent the day it would come out, and sort of read it on the school bus, and just sort of started there, really, as it did. And it, you know, we look back to everyone that I know, that, you know, Spike included, that was around back in those times. You know, everyone looks back at it so fondly. You know, the Volkswagen shows were exciting. As I say, when the magazines came out, it was really exciting. When you went to the Volkswagen shows, you saw all the cars that were in the magazine for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everything was fresh. You were young, you were, you know, excitable. And it was just a great way of growing up. You know, it was really, I think, like I say, we all look back at those years really fondly. And, you know, off the back of it, you know, people like Spike, and, you know, I've got so many friends that I've sort of made, you know, made back then and still, you know, really friendly with still today. People come and go, but, you know, it's the you know, the Volkswagens have what's kept us all together, and it's the amazing thing to be part of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the intro that I cut just before this, I kind of went on a bit of a tangent, and I said, it's interesting to talk to the guys from the UK that had that same love, passion, drive, and desire that we did. And what we had back then is we had like one picture in a magazine that just lit us ablaze. And we got that one picture for 4 years while we're building a car, like, and we're just looking at the people in the background and the way the car sits and the stance and the wheels and like everything. And we're thinking, okay, that's my goal, to be that guy living that life, you know, sitting at a show, polishing the car, like looking at the scrubs coming up, like, yeah, kids, it's pretty cool, but I'm not gonna snub the little kids when they come up to me. I'm gonna talk, you know, because we go to a show.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I remember going to a show and seeing, the first time I went to the Jamboree, I think was 1989 or 1990, and I go there, and it's like, you know, I grew up in Las Vegas, which is the desert, you know, it's a couple hours away, but when you're a kid, you're 16, you know, a 3 hour drive, might as well be the other side of the world. Right.
And I
go to the show with some friends, we rented this minivan and we're down there, and I'm just like, I can't stop. I'm like, holy crap, look at that. Dude, that car's on 8 spokes. This car's on 5, you know, all these super rare, you know, look at these guys got alloys, like all these things. And you're just, your head's on a swivel. And we look back at it fondly, I think partially because maybe some of us had the security of like living at home, and we hadn't gotten serious with adulthood yet. Right. And so I told someone the story the other day. I used to walk into our local VW shop here. I worked at the Olive Garden as a cook, which is like a restaurant, Italian restaurant. I would walk in every Friday with my paycheck. I would endorse my check, go through, pick out the parts, and they would give me the change from my paycheck. So they would accept my check. You know what I mean? And it was so funny because it was just something that they did. Every Friday, the VW people would show up and they'd be like, yeah, we'll go ahead. Yeah, we'll cash your check and give you the change.
Here he comes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm there like, okay, this week I'm buying one 135 and then next week I'll get the other one, you know? And it was, I think part of it becomes this journey that we start on where we're building something that's in our head and there's all these parts and pieces we need. And if you really do the math in the beginning, it's like a really huge task. But as as a kid full of like hope and determination, and it's not, it's different than the mini truck world, because here in the States, in the mini truck, you could go to the store, you go to the brand new Toyota shop, buy a mini truck, buy it there, lowered with wheels and a wing and a camper and all that stuff on it. But that was like for the kids that their family had money or they had a good job or something like that. You know, some of us broke kids, you know, we had to start with this rusted Hulk crap and it was just cover all the wounds and just try to get it to look good from 20 feet away. You know, it was all about the mirage.
Yeah.
But so you get started in, like you get your first Volkswagen and it's just not a hobby for you because this has become your career, like what you've done for a living. So how do you work your way from just the average enthusiast into your first job in the VW world?
Well, it was Carman Connection used to be about where they still are, about an hour and a half away from where I live now and when I was a child. And they used to have what they used to call their Rad Sunday events. And it basically was the VW community would take over the supermarket car park, which was closed on a Sunday in England back in the late 80s. And it would just, 150 cars would turn up from all over the country and just gather. And it was at one of those events, I thought, you know what? Knee-jerk reaction, I'm going to ask for a job here. It looks really cool. You know, and it was, you know, back then, Carman Connection, German car company, it was the mecca, the center of the VW scene. So to get a job there at the time was like, you know, dream come true. And, cut a long story short, I got a job there. And it was German car company was the sort of Cowlick store, if you like, where they sold the sort of, you know, the 135 tires, the sway away adjusters, right, the chrome tin there, the Cowlick window rubber kits, you know, all of the crap that they shipped in from your side of the world.
Yeah.
And Carman Connection was more more vintage. It was more, you know, white wall tires and you know, trim kits, and we used to sell cabriolet hoods, and just you know, to me at the time, it was quite boring, the Carman Connection side of things, if I'll be honest. But then sort of Resto Cal became big, and we were starting to sell more Porsche parts, which interests me, and I learned a little bit about that. And gradually, the sort of people that were working above me at the store moved on, and I kind of graduated up the ranks there until I found myself, me and a friend, Chris, were shop managers there. So we were only probably early 20s at that stage, and we were running under the close supervision of Richie in a really cool shop. The company as well had expanded, Carman Connection had grown into, you know, quite a nice little business. So we were enjoying ourselves, and I started to I'll go back to sort of inspiration. There was a book that I'm not sure if you might have seen it, because it was written by an English author, but it was called Air Cooled Volkswagens by Colin Burnham.
Yep.
And have you seen the book?
I have seen the book, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me and all the UK kids, it was our Bible. It right. was really our Bible. And there was one car in there. It was a Sea Sand fastback that was going down the freeway. I think it was going to Bagarama or something. They had like a big convoy of cars and or caravan, as you guys might call them. And this fastback was like, it was like, that was the car for me. It was just like, I'd never seen a Type 3 look so cool. So whilst working at Carmen Connection, he's got the book. No, that's not the book.
Yes, this is one of the Colin Burnham books that I have, but yeah.
Yeah, that is the sister book. That's classic Volkswagens, air-cooled Volkswagens by the same guy. Really cool book. Fastback was like game changer. Changed my life, that Fastback.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, the guy recently came out of the woodwork that owned the car the day it was photographed for the book. And he came up on Facebook, and I thought to myself, if only that guy knew how much of a bearing he and his car had on my life, you know. So I immediately had to buy. So whilst working at Carmen Connection, I'd seen the book several years before, but it was in the back of my mind. I really wanted a Type 3 or an Oval. So
right.
I actually end up getting a Type 3. A square back, 68 square back, which went on to be featured, became the puppy love car. And again, back then, everyone was kind of, you know, lowering them, painting them silly colours, removing the trim, removing the bumpers. But I wanted to go a different direction. I wanted to keep the body totally stock. It was Savannah beige. Just wanted to drop it nice and low, big set of rims, big motor, which was kind of a little bit different at that stage. It was about 92, and people really still were into painting things purple, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of a left field car, I believe. And so I owned that, and then I finished it. We did the magazine photo shoot. Me and my friend Andy Marriott, who's quite a well-known Volkswagen UK scene character, jumped in the car, and I took him out in it, and it was quite quick, and I nearly killed him in it. We didn't crash, but we came very, very close.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got out the car shaking, he got out the car shaking. I said, I don't want this car anymore, it's going to kill me. And he had a really nice 1500S notchback, which was built by a guy called Clive Prue, who used to be a magazine editor for Custom Car in England. And he'd built the car at kind of a very, very high standard for back in the day, this notchback. And everything was right on the car for me, but I didn't like the colour. Andy really wanted my square back because he had this amazing big motor that he wanted to go and try and cause some carnage in. So right there on the pavement outside Carmen Connection, we shook on a trade deal. So yeah. I got the notch back, he got the square. And but yeah, the notch was on, it was a 65 1500S, it was on split rim 8 spokes, which was wrong for the year of the car,
right?
And it was painted in gunmetal grey, which I believe was too much of a modern colour for a 1500S.
Yeah.
So it was such a well-built car, and I always remember, I'm going to change the colour. So I stripped it down methodically, and because it was one of those car projects where I didn't have to buy any parts, because it was such a good car to start with, it was just the wrong colour. So it was stripped down methodically. My friend Simon, who runs a company called The Paint Box, painted the car for me, and then I reassembled everything, got rid of the four lug wheels, and went back to 5x205, and put on some original 4.5 and 5.5 inch MP Sprint Stars, all detailed up. Like, it was a cool car. It was really nice for the time. It was a really nice car. I painted it beryl green, which is still one of my favorite colors. Technically speaking, it's not a Type 3 color, but I did really like the car. So that was my kind of second magazine feature. And then off the back of that, I kind of had enough of living in Essex, which is where Carmen Connection was. Just kind of burnt, a little bit burnt out with working at Carmen Connection, and we really wanted to go traveling. So I sold the car, I moved back to my folks' house and went and bought a, what is it, a 14 window, is it 14 window? Like a Brazilian bay window.
Yeah.
So 11, 12, 13 window, I think they are. So they have the corner windows, they have split screen van side windows with a bay window front. I bought that, had a load of money left over from selling the Notch, enough to go kind of to do two further things with. One, to go traveling for a few months in this bus. But the other thing, I had some money left over. So I bought some Type 3 parts, and not just a few. I bought like a 7.5-ton truck full of Type 3 parts.
Oh, wow.
Now, I kind of figured that there was some cool stuff in there that I could flip out pretty quickly to get the majority of my money back. And then anything else that was left over, I could sell to sort of fund my sort of traveling.
Yeah.
So what I did was started type three detectives by just putting an advert, a little classified advert in the back of the magazine. Now, a friend of mine, Ivan McCutcheon, who was then the Volksworld editor,
right,
had previously had a little part-time hobby that he called Type 3 Detectives, and he used to do the same, buy and sell Type 3 parts. And I thought he'd stopped doing it. He was now concentrating on his journalism, and I really liked the name Type 3 Detective. So Ivan said, why don't you call it Type 3 Detectives? I was like, okay, yeah, if you don't mind, I really like that. So the advert, we designed a little advert of a Sherlock Holmes looking character with a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
And a little sort of eighth of a page advert in Volksworld saying Type 3 parts. If we haven't got it, we'll find, you know, our detectives will find the parts for you, or something along those lines. So there was a bit of a caveat in there that if we didn't have the bits, then we'd do our damnedest to find them. So a few weeks before I was due to head off into Europe in this wreck of a camper van, the advert came out and the phone started ringing. And so gradually, and another thing that was really cool, that there was an American airbase near where I was living, that when the servicemen would come over from America, they'd bring their air-cooled Volkswagens with them. And then when they'd go home, if they ran out of time to sell the vehicles, they'd just go to the junkyard. So there was a junkyard near me full of air-cooled Volkswagens, in particular, quite a lot of Type 3s. So
oh, wow.
When the phone would ring, if I didn't have the parts in my big stash of Type 3 bits, I'd kind of go to the breaker's yard, the junkyard, get the bits, phone the customer back, go, yeah, I've got the fender, I've got the fuel flap release mechanism, I've got the hood catch. And this was sort of obviously prior to the internet. If they wanted to order, I didn't have any way of taking the payment over the phone, so a check would turn up in the post, or what we'd call postal orders. And, you know, slowly I started to sell bits. Anyway, the time came that I had to disappear off traveling. I went off traveling, came back from traveling, and I honestly had enough money to go and buy some food at the shop, like a weekly shop.
Yeah.
And then after that, I could probably pay my rent for a couple of weeks. But after that, I had no money, zero money, no job, a shitty Volkswagen bus and nothing else. And and then I went into my flat and I had an answer phone on the landline, and I pressed, and it was flashing when I got back from traveling, and I pressed the play button, and there was 145 adverts on 145 answer phone messages on there of people wanting to buy Type 3 bits.
Oh wow.
So I went from having like $25 in my wallet to within a week having a couple of £1,000 from fulfilling some orders that were already waiting for me. And I thought, you know what, this could actually be okay.
Right.
So I kept, you know, I fulfilled some orders, I chased some orders down, I put another advert in the magazine for a few months, and then things started to sort of pick up. And I thought, well, I could have a little business here. So I made it all official. And yeah, that's kind of how it started, really.
Well, now, and being a type 3 guy, especially in the 90s, is like really out of step. I mean, to be a type 3 guy, there's got to be something in you that likes oddball stuff, especially if you're in the custom car scene, because percentage wise, there may have been less than 5% type 3s going on. And the type 3 guys, they were kind of like the bus guys back then. They were a little different. They always had to tell you how their type 3 was better. But, you know, it was definitely something that if you know, they were easier to lower, but they were harder to have good performance because of the pancake engine setup. And they were, but like in the early days of like stereo system, stuff like that, they were perfect for hauling around a huge subwoofer box or those types of things. So, you know, it kind of lends it to what I look at what you've built since then, right? So you're not a regular beaten path type one guy, because you've built some really out of the range stuff that's completely off the beaten path. You know, you've built a Brasilia. I think on your website, you guys also built like you did a front engine air cooled Golf. Is that right?
We did a rear engine air cooled Golf.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have done some wild stuff, and I'm going to guess that spurs from originally being a type 3 guy, right? Like, you love Volkswagens, but you love the stuff that nobody has, or the oddball stuff.
Yeah, we like the underdog. Really do like the underdog, you know. Anyone can kind of, don't know, anyone can go and buy something that's pretty and make it look prettier. But if you buy something ugly and make it look super cool, then that's kind of what I've always liked to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you've got a super slam, looks like a 79 Bay. And then I'm looking at some pictures I pulled up online, and it's got the Golf. I remember seeing the Golf. 2014 was the first time I was in the UK, and I had gone to Volksworld. Was it Volksworld in 2014? No, it was in 17. I went back for EBI, I think it was. And
yeah,
I had seen the Golf, but it was the one that it looked like this Golf here, but it was gray. I thought that had,
that was the same car that, I gave the car away actually in the end, and, gave it to someone that helped me build it. And he took it, and then he painted it gray. He stripped it, and again, an easy resto, pulled it to bits, cleaned it, painted it, put it back together. It's a different car, you know. It's a nice way of doing it.
So just as a question, when you take that Golf, that front-engine water-cooled car, did you actually fit it to a Volkswagen pan, or did you just modify what was existing to carry Volkswagen parts?
Yeah, well, we went back to the same junkyard that used to have all the Type 3s like 15 years previous.
Right.
And they had this, they had a Mark III Golf with there was three cars on its roof, but it was a good solid car. So we pulled it out. We basically cut it into a jelly mold, braced it and cut it into literally a jelly mold.
Yeah.
And then the back half was Type 3. And then we joined it on the spine to a link pin Beetle frame head. And then we made pans to make it back into a monocoque. So it was all welded as a monocoque, and then built front and rear tubs and front and rear firewalls to put the rigidity back in it. And I think we built it in about about a week and a half or 2 weeks.
No way.
And we had the full crew. This was, you know, this is probably 15 years ago. We had the full crew on a Saturday night, prepare, you know, getting the thing running and driving so we could take it to a show the next day. And then we drove it into the show with the Brasilia, the black square black that we built with Gavin Jones at Trailer Queen. We had the Brasilia. We had a TV bus that we built as part of a TV program. And we drove it into a water-cooled show called Players. And at the end of the day, when they had the trophy given, we won every single trophy that they gave out bar two or three. You know, the air cooled guys came in as total outlaws and just took everything. So it was really funny, really funny day. But
and that, when you, yeah, that when, was when cool. You take on a project like that, I mean, That's a pretty far out project to do, to take a Mark III Golf and then fit it and just basically build a VW chassis around it, because it was super cool. I mean, there's no more retro than retro engineering something like that, but it was so wild. You know what I mean? Just because it's like, wait a second, these guys air cooled this thing. You know, it reminds me, there's a picture on the internet of a VW powered mini truck that's got an engine in the back, right? It's in the bed.
Yeah.
But it's like, to do stuff like that, I mean, you're going way out of the box. And the Brasilia, you know, you would see a Brasilia and they're really unattractive in their form. It's like this hermaphrodite rabbit looking thing. But when you take a Brasilia and you just freaking slam that thing. And I remember the picture, you know, the picture that was in Volkswagen where I don't know if you're dragging a trophy or a piece of steel shooting sparks behind the car. But that, I mean, that. The Brasilia. So like the Brasilia, it looks like it was a nice car to start with. Was it?
Well, the Brasilia story started a few years before, actually. And I won't drag on too much, but we don't get Brasilias in the UK. They're not. No one had ever seen one.
Right.
The only reason I knew what they were is because as a child in my early, you know, late teens, I'd spent a lot of time in Portugal, and they had them in Portugal.
Oh, really?
So whilst on holiday in Portugal, we saw a couple sort of almost abandoned by the side of the road, and we had a little poke around, and we noticed that it's got a Type 1 motor in the back, which you wouldn't really expect, because most people look at it and they think it's a Type 4, you know, the car.
Right.
And then the coolest thing about it was that it had a torsion bar front suspension, because, again, you think, oh, it's going to have a McPherson strut. So I thought, and I kind of looked at these two cars by the side of the road, and I thought, yeah, all you'd need to do is lower it, and you'd have a super cool in a set of rims, and you've got a super cool car.
Right.
So fast forward, you know, 4 or 5 years after that, and it was ticking away in my mind so much. I thought, I've got to do one. And then we went back to Portugal on a successful parts buying trip, but it was actually quite a failed parts buying trip. We went to what we were expecting to be a dealer clearance, main dealer clearance, that had been this dealer had been abandoned since the 80s. And we were promised that it was, you know, full of air-cooled parts. Anyway, we got there, and it turned out that every dealer in Europe had picked through this stuff already, and only the dregs were left. So, we went to the pub that evening and drowned our sorrows. And whilst in the pub, we got talking to a guy, and he said, oh, yeah, I know the Brasilia. It's really good. It's cool, and it's like it's cheap. And so I bought the car unseen. It got shipped. We flew back, and then the vehicle came back. Bought it unseen. I shipped it back by boat, and it arrived a couple of weeks afterwards. And when it arrived, it was green, and it only done 12,000 miles from new.
Oh wow!
And it was like there was zero rust. Everything. I didn't have to buy any parts for that car. All of the rubbers were perfect. The door seal. You know, again, it was just like, you know, strip it down, bag it, tag it, paint it, put it back together. Or so we thought. But the what we decided we would do is we said, oh, we'll put a narrow beam on it, and we will put some rims on it. I think we put 15-inch Fuchs on it. And we decided we were going to do like a one-day makeover. And we dropped it to kind of where we wanted it to look. It kind of was about low enough. But then we noticed that the ball joint beam was actually sat on the ground. As you probably know, ball joint beams sit about an inch and a half lower than a link pin beam.
Right.
And it was just like, ugh. It was like the wheels were touching the wheel arches, the tubs, the wheel tubs in the front were really small. So the tires were rubbing on the arch. The beam was on the ground. And if I'm being honest, it wasn't as low as what we wanted it to be. So we thought, right, we're going to have to link pin it. We're going to have to cut the whole, literally the whole front clip off, build some custom tubs that are going to be three times the size of the standard ones. And I'll be honest, the majority of the work on that car was getting the wheels, front wheels, to sit up far enough and to be able to get, you know, we did loads of metal work. Matt, who works for me, well, he worked for me then and he still works for me now. But yeah, he totally made all front custom tubs for it. We made a beam, and then we decided we'd go 17-inch Fuchs on the wheel because they'd just come out back then, and we thought I'd get a detailed set of those on. And then we decided, I don't know what made us decide the white paint, but the white paint with the red Fabistic interior was like a critical part of the sort of design that had in our heads. Like you say, you get that picture in your head, don't you? And you think, yeah, and you can kind of almost, you know, you do this these things for long enough and you can actually visualize exactly how it's going to look before you've done it.
Yeah.
And like I say, we took the body down to Gavin at Trailer Queen and he painted it. But again, it was a really good straight car. We detailed all the pan, did all the pan work, built everything up, and then we threw the pan, the chassis onto the trailer, and took it down to Gavin's, and then reunited the body with the pan. And straight away, as soon as we put the painted body on the pan, you could see we were onto something. Yeah. It was so cool. And then I think we used to really fly really tight to the. Whatever it is, we had like a, I think, 7 days to finish the car before the Vauxworld show.
Right.
Fly by the skin of our teeth. And same with when we were building the Black Square back. It came back from Gavin like a week before the show. And literally I'd be on it full time till, you know, silly o'clock at night building that car. And then we drove it into the Vauxworld show. And it's just like, it was a life. Yeah, a moment in my life, I'll always remember driving that car in, because as we drove it in, it absolutely got mobbed. It was like, you know, 10 people deep, everyone poking at it and wondering what it was. And,
yeah.
You know, you don't, there's not many cars that are driven into that. And I don't like blowing my own trumpet, but the Steve Gilbert's Fridlin had the same response when that drove in. But I don't think, apart from the Brazilian, much else has had that sort of response. Not whilst I've been there, anyway. And it was just mad. Well, and then, you know, credit to us as well. So many people have built replicas of that car. There's many white Brazilians slammed with red basket weave interior. It's kind of quite strange, but yeah. And then I think it got 14 magazine features in different magazines. It was in, I think Hot VWs, Super VWs, Display VWs, Vauxworld, Performance VW, and Brazil, two or three magazines from Brazil. I've never had a car so many magazines wanted to feature. It was mad. Definitely put us on the map.
Well, you know, what's funny is that you look at these cars, and there are certain cars like that. There are cars like that that start kind of, you know, everybody's raising the bar, right? It seems that since, you know, back in the beginning of the scene for our generation, which is like the mid to late 80s into the early 90s, when we're really starting to get our bearings, it was like rag tops were rare, oval windows were rare. And then over the past 15 years now, split windows and Hebmulers, and you see everything coming out of the woodwork, right? Because everybody's searching for that stuff. And I think what happens with something like the Brasília, it becomes a car that's not out of reach for everybody, because if you put the time and effort into finding one, you can get it. And then you can be the guy in your block that's got something rare and you didn't have to spend 80 grand for it. You know what I mean? And, but there are those cars, you know, that's like, and to me, you know, I've always kind of had that when I'm building a car, my attitude with it is like, I want you to know it's my car. I don't want you to confuse it with the other red convertible on Fuchs. You know what I mean? Like my buddy Scott, he was on the cover of Vauxworld, a red convertible with black cup wheels. Him and my buddy Mike Kennedy are in the car. I was there at the photo shoot. I got all the behind the scenes pictures, but I used to just bust his chops. And I said, you need to put the 17-inch cup wheels in the convertible. Don't be another red convertible on Fuchs. of course, after the feature, he goes and puts Fuchs on the car and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you're a numbskull, you know, but you always want to be able to have cars that are memorable. And I think a lot of the stuff that I see you put out are those cars that, you know, from the Golf to the Brasilia, the Squareback. I mean, there's just a ton of cars that you guys put out there that have staying power, or they just kind of get, they get kind of a legendary status. And it's because with the Brasilia, it's because you're so committed to be that slammed. It's like, we don't care. The rocker's got to be sitting on the ground. It doesn't matter, whatever it takes. You know what I mean? And
yeah, you grow up though, don't you?
You know, what's,
I think I'm over it now to a degree.
What's that?
I think I'm over that now to a degree, but we're still trying to do things a little differently. You know, it's we built, I don't know if you saw the Bajas we built.
Yes.
Quite recently.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we kind of thought, you know, I never liked Bajas back in the day, but we kind of, when we me and my ex-business partner now, actually, Mark's moved on to different things, but we sat down and was like, let's reimagine what a Baja could be. And we kind of went back to basics and built a real minimalist, a real sort of subtle coloured Baja. I think it's on the website, like a pale green.
Yeah,
pale green. Actually inspired. We actually took inspiration from like Series 1 Land Rovers. And that was, you know, again, that was just something that no one else was doing, really. And we've actually sold quite a lot of cars off the back of that car. I'm building them to order at the moment, so that's quite good.
I saw the car when I was at Spike's shop last time. So this would have been, I think it was September before when I flew back to go to cruise with Spike over to the Air Mighty show. And I think it might have been in his shop getting some stuff done. And I checked it out. And it's funny because I've had this conversation with some people, and I think the market is to the point where you could spec build some Volkswagens and people would actually line up to buy them, because everybody in the hobby is now in their 40s and 50s, which demographically they've got more disposable income, but less time. And we all know that we're playing the back nine of the golf course now, right? We're all in our 50s. We're on the back side of things. And so we realize how valuable time is, and we look at things in a time-money equation. It's like, if I can just buy that car and enjoy it now, it'll save me the next 56 weekends that I don't have available to try to build it, you know? And I think there's definitely an opportunity out there in the market, I think, on so many levels, especially when you come up with a recipe to build something and just build it consistently, cleanly. You give them their two options, A or B, and that's it. I really think you're onto something with that, you know?
Well, we're doing that. We're also doing a few, again, at the Underdog, we're doing a few 914s for different clients. So yeah. They're pretty good. And there's kind of quite a lot of... there's a company in the UK building them for sort of £350,000. All really, really bespoke cars, really full on. You know, I'd like to say sort of to a singer level, but obviously, you know, probably not. But you know, they're building these cars £350,000, and I'm thinking, well, you can buy one for sort of 20,
right?
And you can buy one for 350, and you can probably buy one for 5. But what can you build for around the sort of 100-150? Because there's definitely, if there's people spending 350k on them and there's people spending 20k, there will be people that will want to spend somewhere halfway between the two. Right. So, and we have sold a few, you know, and we're selling some really, you know, we're building two at the moment. We've got orders for another one. So, and they're going to be super cool. They're going to be coming out. I think the first one's going to be completed in a couple of months' time, but yeah, it'd be one to watch out for. The 914s definitely on the up. Definitely on the up.
And what's the spec on the 914s?
Or I believe they are anyway. They've got to be. And another thing is, why haven't 914s been in
VW community, do you know?
Yeah.
It's like they are so VW, you know, common gears have been embraced, Brazilians have been embraced. Why haven't the VW community embraced the 914s yet? I believe they will.
Yeah. Now, with the 914, what's the spec level build you're going to build that thing to? Like, if you could describe the 914 build, what are the to-do lists on it?
So we're not going full sort of GT arches. We're doing sort of smaller, sort of bespoke arches, full elephant racing suspension with sort of, you know, drop spindles and poly bronze bushed throughout, Bilstein coilovers on the rear. The one we're building at the moment is 2.46 cylinder. So not crazy, but you know, it'll be nice.
Yeah.
You know, very nice paint, very, very nice, you know, stance, real nice interior. Built very, very, you know, minimalist style. No, you know, not too many whistles and bells, very basic in the looks department, but, you know, very, very, you know, concentrated on the handling, the wheels. They're going to be decent cars and, you know, really, really drivable and, you know, good looking things, you know, really good looking things.
Yeah. No, I've always liked the 914. I mean, you don't really realize how small they are until you park one next to like a Karmann Ghia. They're a little bit wider, but they seem to be, they sit really, really low, you know?
Yeah.
But, I've had a few 914s. I've never built one and driven one. I've had several with the intention of like, I bought it, I'm going to get it running. And even the last one, I ended up, I looked at it and I took the EFI off because it wasn't working. I threw some carburetors on it, got it running, realized it had a sucked valve. Then a friend of mine was like, man, I really want that car. Do you want to trade for a Datsun mini pickup truck and some cash? And so I ended up going down the Datsun road for a little bit, but I learned a lot about 914s, especially when I put it up for sale and everyone started asking me, how is the hell hole? And I said, I could not for the life understand what these guys were talking about. And you know, there's a part where the package tray comes down with a drain that usually the pipe deteriorates or gets clogged.
Yeah.
And it just starts rusting them out. Are those now the ones that you're building are left-hand drive or right-hand drive?
Funnily enough, they were both left-hand drive, but both customers are requesting that they're converted to right-hand drive, which we've done.
How hard of a conversion? Were they make like Volkswagens where you could universally make it right or left-hand drive?
Well, from the factory, they were all left-hand drive. They never made a right-hand drive 914. They were converted in the UK by a company called Crayford. Oh, really? I don't think they did. They didn't do. They were a coach builder, and I don't think they did more than probably 20 of them. So a right-hand drive one's extremely rare. So, but they were. Yeah, it was quite a lot of fabrication to convert them. But all of the steering switched over quite nicely. We've made a bespoke dash. Not too bad. Not too bad a job at all, really, to convert. But I don't mind left-hand drive. I love driving left-hand drive cars in the UK. It's fine once you get used to it.
Yeah. And now, so when you switch from type 3 to, what was the transition to make you switch from type 3 to type 2 detectives?
So when we started off as a parts only business, and we had a couple of retail stores where we were literally just doing mail order. The internet happened, and when the internet, you know, my memory of the internet sort of happening was, it's your nerdy friends that had it first. And right. We had still got a friend who was called Dan, and he was a lovely guy, a really cool guy, but, you know, he was a cool nerd, you know.
Right.
And he had an Apple computer, and he was kind of, and he said, oh, you've got to get a website and an email. And I'm like, what is it? And he kind of went on to explain, and I said, well, I don't really understand, but I'll have you build me one. And I think we were the first company to put a web address, an email address in our advert in Volksworld magazine. And we started to sort of, then all of a sudden we started to get emails from Australia and from America. And he was just like, you know, he would, I don't think I even had the internet on my computer. He would get the emails, come to his computer, he'd print them out and bring me, you know, a big folder full of inquiries every day. It was just like, wow, this is going to be good. And then we got online, and then we discovered the fun of getting on the internet, and we started to advertise on the Samba. And so the parts, you know, we started to send lots of stuff over to the States and to Australia and various other places. And we needed a bigger, because we were, you know, starting to sell more, we needed a bigger premises. So we bought our first workshop, and it was in the village where we're based now, probably a 3 or 4 car workshop with parts storage and stuff upstairs. And we got a ramp, and we started to build our own projects in there. And then people started coming and saying, oh, can you lower my Type 3, or can you, you know, build a motor? And we employed Andy Marriott, the guy I mentioned I traded the notch back with earlier. He came to work for me and started building motors in-house. And then we were installing the motors. And then we started to notice we were getting more and more people bringing buses in, and more people bringing buses in than Type 3s. This was sort of, about 1999, when the bus scene was just starting to gain momentum in the UK. So more people were shipping buses in from the States. So we were getting more people with buses turning up, and in, you know, and then all of a sudden, almost overnight, we weren't really doing a huge amount of Type 3 stuff anymore. We were focused on, you know, repairing, lowering, restoring Type 2s. So a friend of mine made a, we used to do the little T3D stickers. They were like the STP logo.
Yeah.
But it said, do you know the red, white, blue STP logos? Well, we ripped them off, and we had our little T3D stickers and T-shirts and decals, blah, blah, blah. And a friend of mine sort of cut and shut one, so it said T2D, and he put it on his bus. And then we thought, oh, we'll get some stickers made. So we started making the T3D stickers and the T2D stickers. And then it just sort of happened, organically happened over a period of time, really. And then we are actually still Type 3 Detectives, you know, limited company, but Type 2 Detectives is the brand. So Type 3 Detectives is actually the official name of our business, but like I say, everyone knows it as Type 2 Detectives or T2D now.
Now let's talk a little bit about how the market has changed since the internet. Like originally you went on your vagabond tour of roaming the world in your bus for a few months, and then came back only to find out putting an ad in the magazine could create a business for you. And now with the advent of the internet, now it's put the power, it used to be that the magazines controlled all the access to the media of everybody that was into that hobby. And now with the internet, it then went from, okay, well now I got to get on the Samba. And now that you're on the Samba, things can blow up. Well, now that's changed a little bit more. Now with social media, it keeps leveling up, putting the power from the big media moguls into the hands of the individuals. And we've seen, I think, especially as a shop owner, right? You've seen several people that don't really have a company, but they can post up some fancy pictures and some pretend products and even snag stuff off the internet and create a company out of whole cloth and, you know, all of a sudden become the new it company out of nowhere. How have you seen the effect? Because obviously you used to carry parts, and if you're the only guy that's selling those parts and you're advertising the magazine, which magazines are more for us like a keepsake for us, right? A journal of time period, right? That's kind of how they are now versus the latest and greatest thing, because now everything's on social media, everything's overexposed. How have you managed kind of juggling that business from where, like, you're king of it all one day because of your ad and the first guy to get a web address, to now it's like it's a constant. And maybe that's answered with the way that your business has evolved, right? From doing parts into service and things like that.
Well, when it first came out, as I said, it was just sort of answering emails, putting adverts on the Samba. There was no social media. The first thing you could probably describe as social media was there was a company in Belgium called Skynet Blogs, mm-hmm. and they had a platform for hosting a blog. So we'd have one. Freddie and Cobus to organise EBI would have a blog. Various other sort of BBT might have a blog, but we managed between probably 25 of us, different companies and people, you know, like I say, just someone that likes to put cool pictures up. We created a community. This was kind of before Facebook. We created a community of VW shops and enthusiasts. So every day we would start to post, you know, I'd get home in the evening, get my laptop out, answer the emails, go online. And then my final job of the evening would be to upload some pictures onto the Skynet blog.
Right.
And that was kind of, it really became a thing, you know, we'd have customers turning up, and this was before Facebook, really. We'd have customers turning up and go, oh, I want you to, you know, do this to my van and do that. And I went lowered, but so they'd give you the keys to their vehicle and go, are you going to put it on your blog? Yeah. And it was just like, it would bring us business. It was just such a good shop window. And people would turn up at our shop and go, wow, this is cool. It's not as I imagined it. You know, it looks different to how it looks online. And it was really good. And then obviously we got Facebook. And Facebook, we built up quite a lot of followers on Facebook. And then Instagram probably took over from that. And again, we enjoy sort of, again, it's a really good opportunity to show the world what we do. In recent times, it hasn't been fantastic for selling stuff, because as soon as you get, as you probably know, as soon as you try and get salesy with a post, they'll shut it down and not show anyone.
Right.
So, you know, you put a picture of a really cool car up with just a picture and it will get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of likes. You put a shock absorber up that you want to sell, and you go, yeah, you know, link in bio, you know they'll show five people and you'll get three likes. So yeah. Which has kind of led us to our latest venture, and we're just creating our own YouTube channel at the moment.
I saw that. I was going to bring it up.
Yeah, and it's been kind of, we put the first episode out two weeks ago, and in 2 weeks we're close to 20,000 views. Now, we're not going to get paid by YouTube for some time, because you've got to have a certain amount of viewing hours, but for 20,000 people to see our shop in 2 weeks is, you know, in my opinion, a fantastic shop window and an amazing bit of exposure. And, you know, we're a bit wooden and we're a bit rusty, but we've got to get three or four more videos under our belt. We'll start to loosen up, and, you know, we've got no shortage of content. So, yeah, we're putting a lot of our time and energy into doing that at the moment.
Well,
but I think it will be good.
It's funny you bring up the views, right? Like, I I've got a little bit of a YouTube channel. I do my podcast, and my podcast, I'm looking at my stats on it, and just through one platform, I'm at about 500,000 downloads. And in the world of looking at the schematic of like, oh yeah, well, this guy gets 10 million downloads. But when we're talking about the niche section of what we do, in other words, 500,000 people have listened to me talk for an hour with interviewing people and things like that. And I think the time commitment to do that and the difference is, it's huge because of what we have. And again, you know, my looking at it has been, you know, I'm doing this because I love the community and I love getting the stories out there, because there's so much cross parallel. But I also love to discuss the business aspect of it, because when you're now looking at YouTube, I just was talking to a guy yesterday, and he produced a TV show. I was talking about his TV show he produced, and I said, how's that going? You know, he just said, listen, TV's dead. Everything's on YouTube. All the stuff's on YouTube. The content's on YouTube. You don't get paid anything. And we were talking about, you know, I filmed a few episodes of Pawn Stars where I'm the car expert for maybe 15 episodes. And, you know, I did it for free just to do it, to just kind of put something else out there that I did, which was fun. And, you know, we were talking about shows, how much people get made. And there's a Chasing Classic Cars with that Wayne Carini.
Yeah.
So much involved in that show. And I think he might get paid about $3,000-$4,000 an episode, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like the amount of work, effort, and energy that goes into those things to where we've come to this time where, but I've noticed two things, right? I've noticed that our generation, we're the transition generation, right? We had the dial-up phones, the AM/FM radios. We had all the analog stuff and converted to digital. Now the young kids, I just had some young kids with the church group I work with here in my shop, in my home workshop, and we were doing some automotive stuff, oil changes, stuff like that. And I was telling them, okay, tell me how many quarts of oil this car takes. And they all just looked around like, well, where are we going to get this information? And I said, the curse of your generation is you guys are so lazy. You have everything at your fingertips and yet you don't look for it. Like our generation, the first thing we do is like, let's go see if there's a YouTube video on it. Let's go see if there's something on the internet about it, because we're the ones that discovered this gold mine of like, wow, all this information. So it's funny as we get older and we start to see the value of a YouTube channel, social media marketing, all that kind of stuff. There's a younger generation that has access to it, but they're almost paralyzed. Like we don't know how to get to it. And so I've noticed that swing in like, you know, our generation. And I think it's because our generation knew how bad it was or how much better it is. You know, so it's interesting.
It makes you wonder how we come to all these so quickly. You forget how it was, don't you?
Oh yeah, but again, like I said when I started this podcast, I said we used to look at one picture, and that one picture would motivate us for a few years.
Exactly.
And now it's like we get this constant overflow of stimulation. Or sometimes you might be on the internet looking for something cool to do, and you're like, well, looks like it's all been done. There's nothing I can do that's more outrageous or more ridiculous than that. But I think there's, you know, in what we do, in the hobby that we're in, there's always something new. And the Volkswagen world it's not like Ford Model Ts. They made the Model T, the model, the three or four different models, but they never had like Volkswagen, because Volkswagen became such a big powerhouse thanks to England and the US by rebuilding the factory, right? It's like it became this automaker that then did so many different things, whether it was, I've got a Ghia TC that I just acquired, a pancake type 4 NATO motor. And it's like, here's Volkswagen building motors for NATO that went into howitzer guns to run the hydraulic system and all that. But it's still the same 1.8 liter type 4 pancake motor that I've got. And then the Brasilia, the Ghia TC, which is this oddball Ghia built in Brazil. So it seems like every year there's something new that comes out that kicks the hobby
forward. So I'm going to have to say that's not me making the silly noises. It's my dog in the background.
Oh, yeah. No worries. It's, but there's,
can you hear it?
Yeah, it's barely coming through. So we're lucky. But there's always something nice. There's always something in the hobby that I think kicks it forward a little bit. So, and I think you're onto something with the pre-built Bajas, with all that stuff. I think there's a market out there where there are people that are looking to get to a vehicle where they can, they want the vehicle of their desire, and they want to just get it done. They want to enjoy it tomorrow. So I think you're definitely onto something with kind of production bespoke build cars that you can't get anyplace else except for what you're doing. And I think you're really onto something with the Baja thing. I think that's really something cool, and it's kind of a keep it simple method. And your options are A and B, and you can pick one up in 6 months. I mean, and I don't think the market's dying. I just talked to a guy who builds replica kit cars. He builds the 356s, the coupes, and the convertibles. And he builds, he does everything from the body to everything. And this guy builds 115 cars a year. He delivers two cars. Yeah, that's what I said. Two cars a week he delivers. Yeah. And I just thought, he's got the recipe down. And he said for years he tried to do, I'm actually going to get him on the podcast. For years he tried to do like a custom off-road shop doing suspensions and chassis and just stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It was expensive, labor involved work, all custom, and he made no money doing it. And now that he's got his recipe down, you know, his customers come in, they give $1,000 deposit to get on the list. When your car is painted and starting to be assembled, you pay your 50% deposit. You pay the balance when you pick it up. And he's got a system down where he's created a system where he's just there. So the market is there. It's just how do you get to that market? You know, here in Vegas, we've got a guy, Renegade Hybrids, and he does V8 914 conversions. That's what he does. Mm-hmm. And I told my brother, I said, well, you think we've got it tough with the Volkswagen thing? Here's a guy that's got $1,500 914s that he's got people dropping 50, 60 grand in them doing drivetrain conversions with LS motors and all this stuff. So
yeah,
there is a market. We're just now in a world, I think, where we've got to fight. We have to fight the algorithm, and we have to try to match up the customer and the desire, you know? And I definitely think it's there. It's ever changing since the beginning. And with that being said, how difficult is it now finding good OEM parts, which is where your business originally started?
Well, we don't do a massively huge amount of restorations. We have at any one time 80 vehicles on site. Mm-hmm. Lots of them are for mechanical overhauls, recommissioning, which means, do you know what recommissioning is?
Yeah.
So something has been, maybe a barn, maybe someone's found something that's been neglected, hasn't been driven for a long time. So we'll get it in and we'll strip it back to the bare bones and, you know, new ball joints, new track rods, new kingpins, new wheel bearings, rebuilt transmissions. So a lot of our stuff is making stuff that's had, you know, 50 years of abuse drive like a new car again. So that's a big part of our business. And because we're using all the mechanical parts, a lot of the time we're using the same parts, you know, week in, week out. We know which suppliers to go to. We know what works. We know what doesn't work. We'll always fit, you know, say to the customer, you know, fit the best part you can, you know, even if it's three times the price, you know, you're only going to pay someone to fit it once. If you buy the cheaper part, it might be a fraction of the price, but you'll be changing it every week. But yeah, restoration, you know, some of the panels aren't fantastically great. That's what slows us down on the restoration. You know, it's hard to get rust-free panels anymore. Bay window doors, rust-free bay window doors are a thing of the past over here. I don't
really
know what it's.
Holy,
yeah. Have you got any?
they're jamming them in the dumpsters over here. Well, my friend Chris, who passed away, had a 7-acre wrecking yard in Hesperia.
That's right. Yeah,
and he told me. He said, Bill, you need to come here. I'll let you bring a trailer and just load up. He says, I've got to scrap it. He says, I can tell you. He says, just get the bay window doors. And I'm like, where am I going to put bay window doors, man? I got no place. He's like, you know, meanwhile, he had 1,000 of them. And, you know, there's always people putting that. And as splitties get really expensive, people move on to bay windows. The affordable crowd moves to bay windows. And to be honest, bay windows are a much nicer driving bus than the splits.
Yeah, so yeah, find me some bay window doors, please, Bill.
You got it, buddy. Well, we definitely got plenty of stuff. So you got your YouTube channel. How do people find your YouTube channel and get in touch with you if they want to check
it
out?
So you can go on YouTube and just search Type 2 Detectives. I think the actual official address is youtube.com/T2Detectives. Just search Type 2 Detectives on YouTube and it comes right up.
In the first episode, we recommissioned a 54 barn door that's been in our warehouse for 10 years. And then I think the second episode comes out this Friday coming, where we'll be hopefully completing it and disappearing off to Belgium in it for a little event next weekend.
Nice.
But yeah, we're going to try and put one out every sort of probably every 3 weeks. We're going to bring them out. So, but yeah, quite exciting, really.
Yeah, you know, it's another layer to connect with customers and people,
exactly.
And to be able to showcase what you do, because sometimes you're standing there in your workshop really proud of what you did and you think, who really cares about this? And there are people out there that care. And I think it's great what you're doing. And anything else you think we didn't cover that you wanted to bring up?
I think we're pretty much there. The only other thing that we do that sort of sets ourselves aside from the majority, you said earlier you had the guys from your church group there learning car maintenance, but we also do a what we call our boot camp, where people come to our workshop and we teach them how to service and maintain their own Volkswagens. So we started that about 10 years ago. We do one every couple of months. They're always fully subscribed. And it's a really good way of, you know, giving something back to the community, meeting the people that own the vehicle, getting a feel for, you know, what they want to learn and what they want to do. So, next time when you're in the UK, you should come and sit in on one. I'm sure we won't be able to teach you anything, Bill, but it'd be a good experience for you.
But honestly, a lot of us garage trained guys, we'll do something so wrong and then go to the actual workshop manual and be like, oh, that's how you do that correctly and easily without having to take a screwdriver.
Yeah, a lot of people have been doing things. Yeah, I mean, we get all sorts of people. We've had people flying from the States to do them. We had one guy flying from the States to do one and told his wife he was going to England on business, which was a bit of a lie. So right. I hope his wife's not listening to this. we get people from, you know, we get, you know, people with all abilities come, you know, even sort of, you know, fully qualified technicians that, you know, aren't familiar with Volkswagens or people that have been working on Volkswagen for years. They just want to come along to see if they've actually been doing it right for so long.
Yeah.
So cool. But yeah, no, we enjoy what we're doing. We're really grateful for what we've got and what we've achieved. And you know, we just love still, you know, 30 years. It's our 30th birthday year this year, and 30 years in, I still really enjoy getting up and going to work in the morning. And I'm blessed, you know. So really am grateful for that.
No, that's great, man. And I appreciate, you know, all the guys like you that put that time, effort, and energy into the hobby and have been lucky enough to turn the hobby into what they do. And it's something that keeps the community alive, you know, because if there wasn't guys that had shops that are putting cars back on the road, there'd be fewer and fewer out there. And then it's a great service to do. So I'm sure sometimes it feels thankless. But we're definitely. I love the way you've pushed the game. You've built the wild cars, and you know it all started from some dumb magazine that you picked up that took you to an escape on a school trip. Exactly. Where you're like, one day I'm gonna be the guy that's got the coolest car on the block, you know. And no, I definitely appreciate it. I definitely appreciate it, puppy. Look, man, I'm looking forward.
Thank you.
I'm gonna be over there for. For EB, I'm going to cruise with I'm going to go on that Cowlick cruise with a bunch of guys. And matter of fact, my car, my Type 34 should be getting a spikes place pretty soon. So when I'm out there, maybe I'll pay you a visit. I'm going to come a few days early. Maybe we'll do a little shop tour for you guys and stuff.
Yeah, you definitely. You can come and star on our YouTube channel.
There you go. Perfect. I love it. Well, man, thanks.
Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. And if people want to get at you, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Facebook, internet, or what?
Just drop me an email, info@type2detectives.com, or you can just jump on type2detectives.com and just hit the contact button. And yeah, I oversee everything, so you'll catch me.
Oh, perfect, man. Well, thanks again.
Please go and check out our YouTube. Like I said earlier, it's youtube.com
and I'll put
at T2Detectives.
And I'll put a link in the description for the podcast so people can go subscribe to your show.
Yeah, enough shameless plugs. Thank you.
Wow, perfect. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on, brother.
It's been great. Thank you ever so much.
It's always great to get a perspective from the other side of the world in this VW hobby that we have. I'm excited that we're able to get Paul on here. Look forward to getting a catch up with him when I'm going to be in the UK later on. And if you guys are in the UK, go check out and sign up for his training courses that you can get to where you can service your own vehicle, which will be pretty handy for you and give you a good feeling and sense of accomplishment. And you'll be able to keep yourself from getting stranded on the road. Don't forget to support the sponsors of Let's Talk Dubs, VW Trends Magazine, a magazine for the people, by the people. New issue coming out soon. So go check out VW Trends Magazine today and subscribe. So if you're looking for high quality aftermarket parts built for enthusiasts, by enthusiasts, go check out Ross Wolf today. Purveyors of speed and style for your air-cooled VW. They've got the dopest of the dope. You want billet shift rod couplers. You want billet pulleys that look like factory. You want big daddy 36 millimeter nuts for your alternator that look vintage, but they've got a three bolt flange that's way tougher than anything else on the market. You want some cool parts and pieces, go to rosswolftoday.com. Don't forget, they also just came out with some high performance braided looking like vintage race spark plug wires. So go check those out today. Just laced up the supercharged motor. Look for an Instagram post on that with some Ross Wolf goodies on that. So wanted to give a shout out to Reed Hoodle in Redmond, Oregon. Appreciate you for supporting the podcast. Kenneth Nash in Concord, North Carolina. Appreciate you repping for us on the East Coast. And Dwayne Pengilly from Thule, Utah, man. Appreciate you guys for supporting the podcast. I love being able to provide these podcasts for you guys, and it makes me happy that you guys get a lot of enjoyment out of these episode. So more to come next week. Russell with Old Speed, the history, just the beginning. We had a good one. It's about a 2-hour podcast, and that one's going to be coming out next week. So share this podcast with all your friends, and don't forget, book your rooms today for one crazy weekend, October 3rd through the 5th. Guaranteed the best time you're going to have in your Volkswagen. I look forward. It's coming up quick. It's only a few short months away, 7 months away to be exact. And I'm stoked, man. It's going to be such a rad time. Appreciate all you guys for everything you do. And I will be at Drag Day this weekend. So popping down there with a buddy of mine, hand out some flyers for one crazy weekend. If you see me, say what's up. If you got something for sale for a sweet deal, let me know. You know, just kidding. Last thing I need is more stuff to bring home. But you never know. I'm always buying nonsense. But anyway, guys, until next week, later.